Okay, we continue the story of David as we turn now to the book of 2 Samuel. We finished up 1 Samuel in our last session, but it was in no sense the finish of anything. It's not a logical end to anything. 1 and 2 Samuel are arbitrarily divided between chapter 31 of 1 Samuel and what we now call chapter 1 of 2 Samuel, but in the original book, this was only one ongoing book, so technically we are now turning to 1 Samuel chapter 2, but it's in our Bible it's called 2 Samuel chapter 1. So the story continues. And in the end of the book that we call 1 Samuel, there was a battle on Mount Gilboa between Saul and the Philistines. The night before, Saul had consulted a medium, and the spirit of Samuel had come up and told him that he and his sons were going to die the next day. It was a prophecy that came true. Saul was first injured by archers among the Philistines, and he knew that he could not recover. He knew that it was just a matter of time, and the Philistines would catch up with him, and their contempt for him, and according to the ancient customs of the time, he could expect that they would abuse him and kill him slowly, that they would torture him, bring as much humiliation to him and pain as possible before killing him. So he was he could see the writing on the wall. It was just a matter of time they'd catch him. So he decided he wanted to die suddenly at the hands of his armor-bearer, who refused to kill him. So Saul fell on his own sword, we're told, and committed suicide and died. His armor-bearer saw also that he was dead and fell on his sword as well and died. That certainly shows loyalty, though I'm not sure if it's smart. But the three of the sons of Saul also died in battle on that occasion. Now, Saul's body was decapitated by the Philistines and hung up on the wall of Beth Shan, but the people of Jabesh-Gilead, who were in debt to Saul for the previous time that he'd rescued them from a siege, came down into the Philistine territory at night, took the body of Saul and Jonathan and the others, and burned their bodies and buried their bones. The story of the people of Jabesh-Gilead taking and interring the bodies of Saul and his sons probably belongs to a time several days later. And the story we now read at the beginning of 2 Samuel, where David learns of the death of Saul, it's hard to know how long it took him to get that news. But it is said that when George Washington died, it took 3 weeks for the news of it to get through the colonies. That's how slow news traveled before electricity and telephones and telegraphs and things like that. And so it may have taken some time, some days for David to hear of Saul's death. The people of Jabesh-Gilead taking the body of Saul and his sons and burying them might be told by way of anticipation. That is, it may have happened a little later, but it also may have happened before David heard the news. Now, it came to pass after the death of Saul that David had returned from the slaughter of the Amalekites. Remember, the Amalekites had captured David's women and children and those of his men, and he recaptured them in battle. And David had stayed 2 days in Ziklag. This is the city that Achish, the king of the Philistines, had given to David and his men to live in, thinking them to be loyal patriots of his. Of course, soon after this, David showed his true colors and came back to his own people. But in the meantime, David only knew there was a battle between the Philistines and Israel. He had not yet heard what had become of it. He had not heard who won, lost, or what had become of Saul or his friend Jonathan. So he was waiting for 2 days in Ziklag, and on the third day, behold, it happened that a man came from Saul's camp with his clothes torn and dust on his head. So it was, when he came to David, that he fell onto the ground and prostrated himself. And David said to him, "Where have you come from?" So he said to him, "I have escaped from the camp of Israel." Then David said to him, "How did the matter go? Please tell me." And he answered, "The people have fled from the battle. Many of the people are fallen and dead. And Saul and Jonathan, his son, are dead also." Now, he doesn't mention the other two sons of Saul. And the fact that he does not might suggest that the messenger was aware of David's personal friendship with Jonathan and his aunt Jonathan. He does not indicate the fate of the other two sons of Saul who are also dead, partly because David may not have been too concerned about them. And the young man who told him said, "As I happened by chance to be on Mount Go..." Oh, I'm sorry. David said to the young man who told him, "How do you know that Saul and Jonathan, his son, are dead?" David didn't want to grieve prematurely in case it was just a rumor that was unfounded. So he asked, you know, how can you be sure? And the young man who told him said, as it happened by chance on Mount Gilboa, there was Saul leaning on his spear, and indeed the chariots and horsemen followed hard after him. He doesn't say so here, but leaning on his spear seems to mean that he had to lean on his spear to stand up, that he was wounded, and he was not able to stand under his own strength. It is implied by the way the narrative goes on. And when he looked behind him, he saw me and called to me and said, I said, here am I. And he said to me, who are you? So I answered him, I'm an Amalekite. He said to me again, please stand over me and kill me, for anguish has come upon me, but my life still remains in me. So I stood over him and I killed him, because I was sure that he could not live after he had fallen. And I took the crown that was on his head and the bracelet that was on his arm, and I brought them here to my Lord. Now, this story differs from the story in the previous chapter significantly. In fact, the difference between these stories has been one of those things that critics of the Bible have used as an example of a contradiction in the Bible. We have one account of Saul's death in 1 Samuel 31 and a different account here. I do think the two can be harmonized. And because of that, some have thought there's a contradiction. But we have to remember that the writer of this book wrote these chapters in immediate succession to one another. Remember, this is not really two books. This is one book. And in all likelihood, the writer wrote the first verse of this chapter very probably on the same day, maybe within a few minutes of the time that he wrote the last verse of the previous chapter. It is highly unlikely that the writer would have been so forgetful as to not remember that he had described the death of Saul a certain way in the previous chapter and then do an entirely, about-face and do something very contradictory a few verses later. Therefore, I find it unthinkable that this is actually to be understood as a real contradiction. The writer must have known that the two stories differ, and there must be some way of us working with this difference. One thing that some have tried to do is suggest that maybe Saul fell on his sword but wasn't quite dead. And this messenger came upon him, and the things that the messenger describes as happening happened, that he did finish off Saul. After all, the man did have Saul's bracelet and his crown. So it's not as if the man just fabricated a story out of thin air. He did apparently have some contact with Saul, or else how could he have gotten the bracelet and crown from him? I tried to make that work at one time in my life, but I don't think it will work. Because it simply says that in chapter 1, verse 4, the last line of chapter 3, verse 4, therefore Saul took a sword and fell on it, and when his armor bearer saw that Saul was dead, he also fell on his sword and died with him. Now, there is a remote possibility that this messenger came upon Saul after he fell on his sword and before the armor-bearer killed himself. But the armor-bearer saw Saul to be dead and fell on his sword. And there's no reference in the story to some intermediary party coming in and killing off Saul. The story certainly seems to be written in such a way as to convince us that Saul committed suicide and died by his own hand. And if there was some other way of looking at it, the writer could certainly have added a sentence or two here to tell us of the intervention of this other party. I'm of the opinion that the man reporting in chapter 1 of 2 Samuel is lying, not entirely. He really does have Saul's bracelet and Saul's crown. And therefore, I conclude that the man did come upon Saul's body. After Saul had committed suicide, he found him dead. He was able to quickly do some calculations in his head and come up with a plan. Say, hey, this is David's enemy, dead. No one was here to witness his death. I could take credit for this. After all, David will no doubt be the next king. If I take credit for killing his lifelong enemy, then David will no doubt reward me with some office in the government or something. Now, this is, in fact, the messenger was thinking. Whether his story was a lie or not, he certainly expected to be rewarded for what he said to David. We see David acknowledging this and recognizing it in 2 Samuel 4, verse 10. In 2 Samuel 4, verse 10, when two murderers of Ishbosheth come and bring his head to David, David says in verse 10 of 2 Samuel 4, when someone said to me, told me, saying, look, Saul is dead, thinking to have brought good news, I arrested him and had him executed in Ziklag, the one who thought I would give him a reward for his news. So David recognized that this man who brought the news of Saul's death was an opportunist. Whether or not David believed his story, he nonetheless knew that the man hoped to get something for telling it. And the fact that the man had a motive of seeking a reward for telling it adds the possibility that he may have lied. Now, remember the two chapters that describe the death of Saul, that at the end of chapter of 1 Samuel and here at the beginning of 2 Samuel, are written by the same author, probably within a few minutes of each other. The one in 1 Samuel tells us what happened. The one in 2 Samuel tells us what this man claimed happened. And the Bible often records the reports of people who don't tell the truth, including the devil himself and the brothers of Joseph and others. We have their words, and many times their words are in conflict with the facts. But always the Bible tells us what the facts are before it tells us what the liars said, so that when we read what the liars said, we'll immediately notice, oh, they're not telling the truth. And that is no doubt how the author intended for us to understand this difference. He's just told us what really happened. Now he tells us what this man said happens. It's different. The man is lying. The man is hoping to get a reward. And he was fortunate enough, he thought, to come upon Saul's body before the Philistines got there to strip it. And so he took some tokens to prove that he had been there and fabricated a story about his being the one who dispatched Saul. Now, he told the story in such a way as to not make him an outright cold-blooded, treacherous murderer. He says that he did it at Saul's request. It was mercy killing. It was euthanasia. The man was in misery. He was going to die anyway, and he was in pain. He wanted to die. Doesn't a man have the right to die? This man just claims to have been the Dr. Kevorkian in the case to come and help him along more comfortably into the next world. Now, David may have believed the story. For one thing, David had not heard the contrary story yet. Somewhere along the line, he may have heard the true story from someone, but David had no reason to doubt the story at this point. Therefore, he took the man's word for it. But it's obvious that David did not believe in euthanasia, as we shall see. Verse 11, then David took hold of his own clothes and tore them, and so did all the men who were with him. And they mourned and wept and fasted until evening, for Saul and for Jonathan his son, for the people of the Lord and for the house of Israel, because they had fallen by the sword. Then David said to the young man who told him, where are you from? And he answered, I am the son of an alien, an Amalekite. It's ironic because Saul was supposed to exterminate these people, and now one of them comes along claiming to have been Saul's executioner. And David said to him, how was it that you were not afraid to put forth your hand and destroy Jehovah's anointed? Then David called one of the young men and said, go near and execute him. And he struck him so that he died. So David said to him, your blood is on your own head, for your own mouth has testified against you, saying, I have killed the Lord's anointed. Now the man may have been actually innocent of the deed, but he claimed to be guilty of it. And by his own mouth, he condemned himself. And if he had not done it, he claims to have done it. And the deed, David felt, was a capital offense. Now, actually, if David had thought, as many modern Americans feel, the man did a good deed killing Saul. I mean, if I were injured in excruciating pain with arrows hanging out of my body, my enemies were coming upon me, and I knew they were going to torture me, abuse me, humiliate me, make my lingering moments more miserable, and I had the option of dying suddenly and avoiding all of that and ask somebody to kill me, I would feel he's doing me a favor. But that doesn't mean it's okay. It's God who decides when men die. It's not for man to take that into his own hands. There are times, of course, when God sent his people to war, thus determining that their enemies should die at that time and in that manner. But if God is not taking your life from you yet, it's not for you to take it. As you probably are aware, it's in the news right now, just as of yesterday, the Supreme Court has been hearing arguments about euthanasia, about the right to die, as they call it. And people are touting the decision, which I don't think the decision has been made yet. I haven't heard if it was, but they began to discuss it. Charlie, do you know? Have you heard? Oh, man. Now, is the decision made, or are they just arguing at this point? I'm not sure. I would imagine they'd take more than one day to consider. I know they started considering it yesterday, so I don't know what the outcome is or will be, but there's many people saying that this is very much like the Roe versus Wade case. It'll set a precedent for being able to kill people who have done no crime. So what? It's at their request. Of course, many critics of this policy believe that once it is established that we have the right to die, there may be some who will come to think of it as a duty to die. It may be imposed upon them. You know, you're a burden to your family. You know, you may be living relatively comfortably and fruitfully for a few more years, but look at the financial burden you place on your family and so forth. You really have a duty to snuff yourself. So the right to kill somebody because they're tired of living can easily be turned around to become a duty to die, and pressure be put on people when they're not tired of living. And of course, it's just another way of taking God's prerogatives in the hands of man. By the way, to call this the right to die is a euphemism, and it's certainly a misnomer. No one would deny that everyone has a right to die. In fact, everyone will exercise that right. Everybody's going to die, and we all have the right to die. The question is, do we have the right to kill? That's different. The question is not, do I have a right to die? Of course, when God wants me to die, I shall die. I'll exercise my right to die at that point, and no sooner. I don't have the right to kill myself, nor does anyone else have the right to kill me unless I do something worthy of death. And therefore, be careful about the media. The headlines are all over yesterday and today. You know, the right to die, the right to die. It's a fundamental right to die. Well, that's a different issue than the right to kill. And what's being decided is not the right to die, but the right to kill innocent people just because they feel they're tired. I would suggest to you that even if the dying process is lingering and painful, as it certainly would have been for Saul had he committed suicide, still God is aware of that. And God knows exactly the sum total of trials and pains that you need to deal with before you die. I mean, our trials are there to prepare us for eternity. If we respond properly to them, if we cut it short, we may go into eternity unprepared when God would have used our final agonies and pains as a means of sanctifying through our, you know, looking to Him instead of to man for relief or for help. So it is certainly, it's simply lack of faith, and it's simply taking God's prerogatives on themselves when doctors and legislators feel that we should be allowed to kill people when they want to go, or that people should be allowed to kill themselves. Remember, you are not your own. You've been bought with a price, Paul says in 1 Corinthians 6. And therefore, the fact that you may not want to live anymore is irrelevant. You're not your own. It's not for you to decide when you're going to die anymore than it's your right to decide when I'll die. You don't have the right to kill your own body any more than you have the right to kill mine or anyone else's. Your body's not yours and mine isn't yours. It's just none of your business when you die. It's God's business. And therefore, David, who was a man after God's own heart, did not share this Amalekite's right to die philosophy. This guy felt like he was not only doing something justifiable, but commendable. Here's a man who's wounded, he's in pain, he wants to die quickly, I helped him. And David said, you'll die for that. And he did. Now, of course, not everything David did is commendable, and one could argue, well, David was kind of just reacting emotionally, and that wasn't right for David. However, it is true. I will not say that anything David did was right. But this man, David was himself qualified to do but would never have done. And I believe that David had the heart of God in this matter. Anyway, that's maybe some would debate that point, but I'll stand with David in this case. He certainly seems to have divine justice on his side in this case. Verse 17, then David lamented with this lamentation over Saul and over Jonathan his son, and he told them to teach the children of Judah the song of the bow. Indeed, it is written in the book of Jasher, which is a book, of course, that is no longer available to us. And these historical books of the Old Testament often make reference to otherwise unknown books that are said to contain the same information or more information on the same subject. In books of Kings, you'll find it all the time. They'll say, and the rest of the Acts of Hezekiah, from the first to the last, are they not written in the Chronicles of the Kings of Judah? The Chronicles of the Acts of the Kings of Judah, or something like that. This book of the Chronicles of the Acts of the Kings of Judah is not available to us anymore. It is a book that the writers of these books had and knew of, and apparently even gave more detail than these writers gave. Those books, sadly, are lost. Maybe it's not sad. I think God sovereignly would have preserved them if they were needed or belonged in our Bible. It's possible that God allowed some of these books not to be preserved because although they were interesting history and maybe even reliable history, they weren't inspired, and had they survived, we might be inclined to put them in the Bible, and maybe they didn't belong there. Anyway, there's a book called the Book of Jasher where David saw to it that this song that he composed, a eulogy for Saul and Jonathan, was to be entered and memorized by the children of Judah. Verse 19 gives the beginning of this song, which occupies the rest of the chapter. The beauty of Israel is slain on your high places. How the mighty have fallen. Tell it not in Gath. Proclaim it not in the streets of Ashkelon. lest the daughters of the Philistines rejoice, lest the daughters of the uncircumcised triumph. In other words, he was that the Philistines in Gath and Ashkelon, Philistine cities, would never hear of this because they'll exult over that which is really a tragedy. O mountains of Gilboa, let there be no dew, nor let there be rain upon you, nor fields of offerings, for the shield of the mighty is cast away there, and the shield of Saul not anointed with oil. Anointed with oil refers to the fact that battle shields in those days were made generally of wood stretched over with leather. They usually had a leather covering. I don't know if this was mainly for looks or if there was some other practical reason for it, but where metal shields were not available or simply were too hard to make with the older technology, they usually made shields of wood with a stretched leather covering. But of course, leather out in the weather tends to dry up and get cracked and so forth. And so they would maintain it the same way you'd maintain your leather boots or other leather things that are exposed to weather. You'd oil them. And so they typically maintain their equipment. Among other things, they would oil their shields to keep the leather from drying up and shrinking and maybe pulling the shield in on it or whatever. So anointing the shield with oil is how they maintained shields. And he's saying here, on Gilboa, where Saul has fallen, the shield is discarded. It's no longer to be maintained. It's not going to be anointed with oil anymore. For the blood of the slain, from the blood of the slain, from the fat of the mighty, the bow of Jonathan did not turn back, and the sword of Saul did not return empty. This is probably not referring to the battle that has just occurred, but to exploits that both Jonathan and Saul had been famed for. We do not read that they did anything marvelous in this battle at which they fell, but David is reminiscing about their former exploits and what a tragedy it is that they would come to such an end as they have. Saul and Jonathan were beloved and pleasant in their lives. It's a strange way for David to speak of Saul, though David is a man like any healthy spiritual person who tends to cause unpleasant memories to be put aside and to remember the more positive things. I've heard, of course, I don't put any stock in psychology, but I think sometimes they recognize trends correctly, and I've heard that many psychologists say the mark of a healthy mind is its tendency to remember favorable, happy experiences and to forget about things that are unhappy experiences, where the mind that they would describe as sick, of course, in their mental health jargon, has a tendency to forget good things and to remember disappointments and times that people, displease them and so forth. And of course, you don't need the psychological jargon to see the truth of that. There are certainly people of two types. There's people who are thankful and tend to remember the positive things, and the negative things they just kind of put out of their mind for the most part. And there are others who seem to dwell on their bitterness over wrongs done. David was of the first type. Certainly, he could have been justified in speaking of Saul other than beloved and pleasant. But there was a time in Saul's life when he was a great hero, who was still following God, when he was used by God. And it's that David chooses to remember him for. Saul and Jonathan were beloved and pleasant in their lives. And in their death, they were not divided, which is one of the most tragic things for Jonathan. He should have been divided from his father by the time. But because he was not, he died with him. They were swifter than eagles. They were stronger than lions. O daughters of Israel, weep over Saul, who clothed you in scarlet with luxury, who put ornaments of gold on your apparel. How the mighty have fallen in the midst of the battle. Jonathan was slain in your high places. I am distressed for you, my brother Jonathan. You have been very pleasant to me. Your love was wonderful to me, surpassing the love of women. How the mighty have fallen, and the weapons of war perished. This statement about the love between David and Jonathan surpassing the love of women, we live in a kinky society. We live in a time when homosexuals are continually trying to affirm their own orientation from any source they can. And they frequently try to point to David and Jonathan, and even blasphemously even point to Jesus and his disciples, as if there was something kinky, something perverted. They wouldn't call it perverted. They'd call it, beautiful, but what the Bible would call perverted between them. And a verse like this is just something they just love to grab onto. Look at that. David and Jonathan, they loved each other more than they loved women. And yet they were both men. What's that tell you? Well, it doesn't tell you what the homosexuals think. The biblical writers and David, he wasn't thinking as a pervert. There is such a thing as tremendous attachment and fondness between persons of the same sex, that has no sexual connotations whatsoever. To say that his love for Jonathan surpassed his love for women is not speaking anything about the sexual aspects of a relationship. He's simply saying that their fondness and their attachment and loyalty and so forth to each other was greater than they had even to their wives. And that seems clear enough from, I don't know about Jonathan's behavior toward his wife, but David wasn't all that loyal to any of his wives. I'm not saying that he wasn't as loyal as could be expected under those customs, but his wives were not special to him in the sense that Jonathan was a special friend. There were few in David's life that he had quite the closeness to as he had with Jonathan. And that's all he's referring to here. When it takes a corrupt mind to make something corrupt out of this. To the corrupt, all things are corrupt. Chapter 2, it happened after this that David inquired of the Lord, saying, shall I go up to any of the cities of Judah? Now, he's been in the Philistine territory all this time, but there doesn't seem to be any reason why he has to stay among the Philistines now that there's no one pursuing him. And Judah is his own tribe, his own countrymen there would be hopefully the first to want him back. But he still didn't presume. He first asked the Lord, is this the right time? I mean, you seem to have cleared the way, but I'm not going to presume anything. I need to know, is this your time? Shall I go up to Judah? And the Lord said to him, go up. And David said, where shall I go up? And God said to Hebron. So David went up there, and his two wives, Ahinoam and the Jezreelitess, and Abigail, the widow of Nabal, the Carmelite. And David brought up the men who were with him, every man with his household, so they dwelt in the cities of Hebron. So for the first time, David's men didn't have to be outcast from Israel for a long time. Yeah.
How do you think, God spoke to David when he spoke?
I think through the Urim and Thummim. I'm not sure how the Urim and Thummim worked. Now, David also had friends who were prophets. Gad, for example, has already been giving counsel to David, but we're not told that Gad traveled with him, but we are told that the priest had the ephod with him while David was traveling. So the most likely way that God spoke to him and that he inquired the Lord was through the Urim and the Thummim. That was a fairly typical thing, I think. No, except they were stones. But we don't know how they were two stones, but we don't know in what way they worked. In an earlier class somewhere back there, I mentioned some of the theories, but no one really knows how the Urim and the Thummim were consulted or how it is that they gave an answer. Ron taught about it also. Yeah, I know. It came up in 1 Samuel somewhere back there a few sessions back, and I briefly comment on it. But we really don't know. People guess, but no one knows for sure. They were the stones that were in the breastplate. There were stones on the shoulders of the high priest, but then there were chains from those suspending the breastplate, on which was just a bag, really, with 12 gems on it. And inside the bag were the two stones, the Urim and the Thummim. And they would be drawn out by the priest to get information, but I don't know if it was like drawing straws or if there was some more supernatural thing happening. I mentioned that, you know, God wasn't answering Saul by the Urim and the Thummim. If it was just a matter of drawing straws, you wouldn't know whether God was answering or not. You could always pull the stones out of the bag, whether God was talking or not. So I think there must have been something more indicative that God was giving a clear answer. But it's summarized here as if the reader already knows these things. But, of course, it was written to people who lived back when the Urim and the Thummim were still around. We don't have them and we don't know much about them except these few things. So David went up there, he and his two wives, he and his men dwelt in the cities of Hebron, in the region there, probably the suburbs of it. And verse 4, then the men of Judah came, and there they anointed David king over the house of Judah. And they told David, saying, the men of Jabesh-Gilead were the ones who buried Saul. Now, I don't know why they told David this. Perhaps they thought that David would want to punish the men of Jabesh-Gilead because of obvious loyalty to Saul. But once again, people had a hard time reading David. The Amalekite who brought the news of Saul's death certainly miscalculated David's response to information of this kind. And if the men of Judah thought David might order them to go to battle against the men of Jabesh-Gilead, they were to be surprised. David sent messengers to the men of Jabesh-Gilead and said, you are blessed of the Lord, for you have shown this kindness to your Lord, to Saul, and have buried him. And now may the Lord show kindness and truth to you. I also will repay you this kindness, because you have done this thing. Now, therefore, let your hands be strengthened and be valiant, for your master Saul is dead, and also the house of Judah has anointed me king over them. Now, the men of Jabesh-Gilead were not yet under David. Only the tribe of Judah had accepted David. They were his tribe. There remained a period of time where Judah was still, because of their acceptance of David, was alienated from the other tribes. This period of time was a total of about 7.5 years. David reigned in Hebron for 7.5 years over Judah before the rest of the nation came under him. Now, the reason for this is not certain. When Saul died, there was one remaining son alive, Ishbosheth, and as the custom would be for the son to take his father's throne, Ishbosheth was recognized as the next king by most of the tribes to the north. They had, after all, accepted Saul right up until the day of his death, and therefore it seemed natural for Saul's son to take his place. And so there continued for a while war and hostility between Judah, which accepted David as their king, and the remainder of the tribes who accepted Ishbosheth. But Ishbosheth, as it turns out, becomes assassinated by two of his men, and then David has no more rivals in the whole of Israel, and he becomes the king over all of them and reigns for another 33 years. So altogether he reigns 40 years, but which the first 7.5 were only over Judah. Now, verse 8, Abner, the son of Ner, commander of Saul's army, took Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, and brought him over to Mahanaim. Mahanaim means the two companies, two encampments. And you might remember that Jacob, that's where Jacob divided his troops or his family and servants into two companies because Esau was coming. He hoped that if Esau smote one, the other would get away. It's also there that Jacob saw angels, a troop of angels, as he was re-entering the land of Canaan after having been away at Laban's for some years. This is the place that Ishbosheth was made king by Abner. And Abner made Ishbosheth king over Gilead, over the Asherites. Now see, the Gilead would be also the people of Jabesh-Gilead that David has just commended. And probably Gilead is mentioned as the place that Ishbosheth was made king because the people of Gilead had just shown their loyalty to Saul by burying his body and his bodies. Abner probably figured, oh, these are the people who would be most amenable to Saul's son being the next king. So he recruits them, the Asherites, over Jezreel, over Ephraim, over Benjamin, and over all Israel. Now, why didn't Abner just settle for David being king? What vested interest did Abner have in Ishbosheth becoming king? That's obvious. Abner had led the armies of Saul against David for these years of David's exile. Abner had tried to kill David, although he had been loyal to Saul, and at a time when many of Saul's army leaders were defecting to David, Abner never did. Abner stayed hostile to David through the entire time of Saul's lifetime. It was obvious that Abner would never hold the same high command of, you know, five-star general or whatever it would be in David's administration as he held in Saul's. If Ishbosheth were king, if Saul's dynasty reigned, then Abner would continue to have the highest military post in the country. However, if David reigned, then Abner would just be another guy in the military. He might be able to survive. David might not execute him, but if he did let him live, certainly he would not give him the post that Saul had given him. One of David's mighty men who traveled with him and suffered with him would certainly hold that post. And sure enough, Joab would have that post. And so Abner had a vested interest in not seeing David rule over the whole country. If he did, there'd probably be no place safe for Abner to go. So he wanted to see Ishbosheth be the king. Now, Ishbosheth, Saul's son, was 40 years old when he began to reign over Israel. And he reigned 2 years. Only the house of Judah followed David. And the time that David was in Hebron over the house of Judah was 7 years and 6 months. Now, there's a bit of a problem here, not too hard to solve, but it's on the surface a problem. It says that Ishbosheth reigned for 2 years. Well, a little later, not far from here, a couple chapters hence, we'll read that Ishbosheth gets killed. That's the end of his reign. And then it seems immediately afterward, David becomes king over all of Israel. However, we're told that the whole time that David reigned in Hebron was 7.5 years. Now, if we are to assume that Ishbosheth was made king over Israel at the same time David was made king over Judah, which is perhaps the impression we get from a casual reading, and David became king over everybody upon Ishbosheth's death, but Ishbosheth only reigned 2 years and David reigned 7.5 years, there's a disparity there of 5.5 years. Do you see what I'm saying? Do you see the problem? Probably, the wars with the Philistines continued for some time. Maybe that 5.5 years disparity is the time that the northern nation continued to make war with the Philistines after Saul's death, before Ishbosheth actually had the peace in his kingdom to be coronated. It's possible that Abner was involved in the battle for years with the Philistines before he had the luxury of coronating Ishbosheth. Another possibility is that Ishbosheth was coronated right away, and in fact there is a typographic, or not copyist error here, what we call a typo in modern printing, but it'd be a copyist error. So it's possible. We don't know. There's no way to confirm it, but it's possible that 7 years instead of 2 years is how long the Ishbosheth reigned. But we would have no way of confirming this. It's just a theory out of the clear blue sky. It could be true, but there's no way to confirm it. So it's one way or the other. It's possible that there was battle for 5.5 years where Abner spent driving out the Philistines and left only 2 years of the 7.5 for Ishbosheth to reign at the end of time. But it's only a guess, and we don't know the answer for sure. Okay? Now, Ishbosheth, the name Ishbosheth actually means man of shame. And it seems like a strange name for a king to name his son man of shame. Actually, it would appear Saul had not named him man of shame, but had named him fire of Baal, which is Esh Baal. We get this from 1 Chronicles 8:33. Still seems like a strange name for a Jewish king to name his son, fire of Baal. But in 1 Chronicles 8 and verse 33, we have reference to Ishbosheth as Esh Baal. It says there, Ner begot Kish, Kish begot Saul. Saul begot Jonathan, Malchishua, Abinadab, those are the three that were killed with him in battle, and Eshbaal. Okay? So Eshbaal is apparently the same as Ishbosheth. Now, what I think we should understand is that the Jews of a later time objected to names with Baal in them. The name Baal literally means Lord, but it was a Canaanite word for Lord. And basically, Eshbaal means fire of Baal, or fire of the Lord, but not necessarily Jehovah. And at a later time in Jewish history, the Jews objected to these. Some people had Jewish names that had Baal in them, and just the mention of Baal was an offense to a more pious later generation. So in speaking of these people, they would change their names. They'd change the Baal portion to something else. In this case, Eshbaal was made Ishbosheth in the later records. Eshbaal was offensive, but Ishbosheth is son of shame, or son of a shameful thing, or man of a shameful thing. And this reflects the later writers' contempt for Baal. And they want to place Baal's name with the word for a shameful thing. The same is true of the name Mephibosheth, Jonathan's son, Mephibosheth, which means, I forget what Mephibosheth means, but it obviously Bosheth at the end also means shameful thing. His name in 1 Chronicles 8:34 is given as Merib-Baal. If you look at 1 Chronicles 8:34, the son of Jonathan was Merib-Baal. Well, again, Baal is in his name. And so in the books of Samuel, rather than calling him Merib-Baal, they changed the name Mephibosheth. Again, changing Baal to Bosheth, which is a shameful thing. So both Eshbaal and Merib-Baal, Saul's son and his grandson, for some reason were given names that incorporated the name of Baal. A more pious later generation of Jews in 1 Samuel and 2 Samuel objected to the use of the name Baal, and so they nicknamed him. And they changed the word Baal to Bosheth, which means shameful thing, and that's why there's a difference here. Okay? All right. Now, verse 12, 2 Samuel 2:12. Now, Abner, the son of Ner, and the servants of Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, went out from Mahanaim to Gibeon. And Joab, the son of Zeruiah, and the servants of David went out and met them by the pool of Gibeon. So they sat down, one on one side of the pool, and the other on the other side of the pool. Now, there was not hot war between David and the rest of Israel, but there was not friendliness either. Abner had set up Ishbosheth as king, and the people of Judah had set up David. Now, both groups had been won under Saul. So there was ill feelings, but there had not been any battle between them. However, this little incident we're about to read of sparks a fighting war, a shooting war. Okay, Then Abner said to Joab, "Let the young men now arise and compete before us." And Joab said, "Let them arise." So they arose and went over by number, 12 from Benjamin, followers of Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, and 12 from the servants of David. And each one grasped his opponent by the head and thrust his sword in his opponent's side. So they fell down together. Therefore, that place was called the Field of Sharp Swords, which is in Gibeon. So there was a fierce battle that day, and Abner and the men of Israel were beaten before the servants of David. Now, what this contest between the 12 men of Benjamin and the 12 men of David's servants is very confusing because its meaning is never explained. However, I think the meaning of it can be deduced. There were 12 from each side, obviously representing the 12 tribes of Israel. Now, they were not one man from each tribe, but the idea was this was going to be a contest to see who would reign over the 12 tribes. Currently, Ishbosheth reigned over 11 and David over 1. However, the one that David reigned over was a big one and a powerful one. And neither David nor Ishbosheth had all 12 tribes under him. Now, if the matter could be settled by a contest similar to how David had killed Goliath and settled the score between Israel and the Philistines, if representative fighters, if champions from both sides could compete, and one side won over the other, that would settle the problem. That is, if David's men conquered Saul's men, or Ishbosheth's men, or Abner's men, then David would rule over all 12 tribes. If Ishbosheth's men beat David's men, then Ishbosheth would rule over all 12 tribes. This is not stated, but it seems likely. The number 12 of the contestants seemingly being symbolic. And the result being turned out the way it did. You see, neither side won. The valiant 12 champions on Ishbosheth's side were about equal in valor and strength to those of David's side, and so they all fell down dead at the same time. It was an equal match. Because it was equal, there were no winners. There was no one left standing. And because of that, there had to be a shooting war. You see, if it had been like when David killed Goliath, or if the reverse had been true, that would have settled the question, supposedly, without war. And it would appear that the Jews were not very disposed to go and shoot at each other. I mean, the men of Judah didn't want to kill their brethren of other tribes. They were all Israelites. They were all God's people. They were all descended from Abraham. They were not interested in a war, but they were interested in being under one king. And there were two contenders. So, as I understand it, each king put forward his 12 best men. And they had a representative contest. The idea was, whichever side wins the contest, that king, but neither side won. So there was a war. And this contest by the pool apparently was to avoid war, hoping to settle the matter without a war. But since it was a dead heat, literally, they had to fight a war after all. So there was a very fierce battle that day. And Abner and the men of Israel were beaten before the servants of David. So although the champions were fairly well matched, David's armies in general were better than Ishbosheth. Now the three sons of Zeruiah were there, Joab and Abishai and Azahel. And Azahel was as fleet of foot as a wild gazelle. So Azahel pursued Abner, and in going he did not turn to the right hand or to the left from following Abner. Then Abner looked behind him and said, "Are you Azahel?" And he answered, "I am." And Abner said to him, "Turn aside to your right hand or to your left, and lay hold on one of the young men and take his armor for yourself." But Azahel would not turn aside from following him. So Abner said again to Azahel, "Turn aside from following me. Why should I strike you to the ground? How then could I face your brother Joab?" However, he refused to turn aside. Therefore, Abner struck him in the stomach with the blunt end of his spear so that the spear came out of his back, and he fell down there and died on the spot. So it was that as many as came to the place where Azahel fell down and died stood still, that is, out of respect to him. These three sons of Zeruiah, Joab, Abishai, and Azahel, were apparently remarkable among David's mighty men. In all likelihood, all three of them had been with David during his time of exile. We know that Joab was and Abishai was. Azahel has not been mentioned before this, but in all likelihood, he was with them too. Now, Abner speaks familiarly with him, and he knows him well, but that's not striking. Before David had fled from Saul, all these men had been in the same army under Abner. So Azahel, the fleet of foot, probably usually involved in carrying messages, he would have been familiar with and under Abner's command before the conflicts between David and Saul broke out. But then the armies had divided between David and Saul during the time of David's exile, and the men of Zeruiah, by the way, the term sons of Zeruiah became a term that David used with disdain later on. He said, "You sons of Zeruiah, how can I bear with you?" Because he considered them to be overly zealous for killing, although Azahel was not particularly a bloody man, at least we don't read of it. But Abner seems clearly unwilling to strike Azahel down, but not because he likes Azahel, but because he's afraid of Joab. He knows that his brother Joab will take it out on him, and sure enough, Joab later did. But when he tells Azahel, why don't you turn aside and get some armor for one of the young men? Probably what he's suggesting is, you are unarmed, and I could kill you with my spear right now. Why don't you, if you're going to pursue me, you better get yourself some protection. But Azahel knew it would slow him down to grab some armor off one of the young men. Why wasn't he armed in the first place, anyway? I suspect he was probably more a messenger, because he was fleet of foot. That's what they use fleet of foot people to do, is carry messages places. He probably was not accustomed to being out in battle. He probably was a fast runner, and he wouldn't be wearing armor, because that would slow him down. But for some reason, just out of his own zeal, he saw Abner going a certain way and thought Abner was going to get away, so he took off after him without a plan, without even a weapon, apparently. I mean, if he got close enough for Abner to hit him with his spear with a blunt end, it seems if Azahel had a weapon, he could have as easily, or a bow and arrow or anything, or a spear, he could have reached out and gotten Abner. But it would appear that Azahel was unarmed. He was just zealous. He was just thinking, I'll catch him, and then when I catch him, we'll see what I'll do with him. It's like when a dog chases a car, you know, what's he going to do when he catches it? You know, sort of a similar situation. Anyway, where Azahel fell, the people stood still and stopped pursuing. They just stood sort of there in reverence to him. Joab and Abishai, the surviving brothers, also pursued Abner. And the sun was going down when they came to the hill of Ammah, which is before Gia, by the road to the wilderness of Gibeon. Now the children of Benjamin gathered together behind Abner and became a unit and took their stand on the top of the hill. And Abner called to Joab and said, shall the sword devour forever? Do you not know that it will be a bitter in the latter end? How long will it be then until you tell the people to return from pursuing their brethren? And Joab said, as God lives, unless you had spoken, surely then by morning all the people would have given up pursuing their brethren. So Joab blew a trumpet, and all the people stood and did not pursue Israel anymore, nor did they fight anymore. Then Abner and his men went on all that night through the plain, crossed over the Jordan, and went through all Bithron, and came to Mahanaim, which is where Ish-bosheth was. So they were defeated. The first conflict between the forces of David and those of Abner ended in defeat for Abner. The people of Israel, I'm sure, were fairly indisposed toward killing each other. They were all relatives. The American Civil War, you know, I mean, people were shooting at their uncles and stuff like that in all likelihood, but Abner was able with just a few words to tell Joab to call off the pursuit, and so the battle ended without finishing up the question of who was going to rule. See, if Joab had pursued and conquered and killed Abner and killed his men, then there'd be no question. David would now rule over everything. Ish-bosheth would be left without an army and would be forced to accept David's rule. After all, that was, I think, they were attempting to decide who was going to rule. Well, Abner lost, but Ish-bosheth didn't lose the kingdom, not yet. So Joab returned from pursuing Abner, and when he had gathered all the people together, there were missing of David's servants 19 men and Azahel. But the servants of David had struck down of Benjamin and Abner's men 360 men who died. So it was a very uneven battle. Only 20 people altogether were lost from David's side, and over 300 and some killed from the other side. Then they took up Azahel and buried him in his father's tomb, which was in Bethlehem. And Joab and his men went all night, and they came to Hebron at daybreak. Now, the reason that Azahel's father's tomb was in Bethlehem is because Zeruiah was related to Jesse. They were Bethlehemites. These sons of Zeruiah were related to David. I think they were his uncles or something like that. I forget. We'll find later on. But there is a relationship between David and these men by blood. Apparently, they were all Bethlehemites. And so they went down to Hebron at daybreak. Chapter 3. Now, there was a long war between the house of Saul and the house of David. But David grew stronger and stronger. Now, it's possible that this long war was the 5.5 years, that David was ruling and disputed over Judah, and maybe Ish-bosheth had ruled 2 years until then, rather than at the end of that time, but that this 5.5 year war was not counted as part of Ish-bosheth's rule because his rule was in dispute. I don't know. It's hard to know how it's calculated. But there was a long war between the house of David and the house of Saul. But David grew stronger and stronger, and the house of Saul grew weaker and weaker. That probably means in terms of the loyalty of the people, the influence and the confidence that people had in David was growing but decreasing toward Ish-bosheth. sons were born to David in Hebron. The first was Amnon by Ahinoam the Jezreelitess. The second, Chileab by Abigail, the widow of Nabal, the Carmelite. The third, Absalom of Maacah, the daughter of Talmai, king of Geshur. Now, we've never read of her before. She was a princess of Geshur. Now, apparently the king of Geshur probably, we are to assume, either had given David some refuge in his times fleeing from Saul, and made it, David had been honored with a princess as a wife at that time, or perhaps, more likely, after David was made king of Judah in Hebron, he probably took Maacah. He probably entered into some kind of a peace treaty or something with the Geshurites, and the king of Geshur gave David his wife. This is a typical way of confirming treaties. Solomon married the daughter of Pharaoh for a similar reason. And it was in the days where kings had harems and a lot of wives were the norm, it was not uncommon to take a princess of some country with whom you were making a contract or a non-aggressions pact and marry them to the other side, the idea being that as long as the king of this country's daughter was married to the king of this country, there'd be no war between them. And that was probably a political marriage there, when David married the son of Maacah, Absalom was her son. The fourth son was Adonijah, the son of Haggith. The fifth, Shephatiah, the son of Abital. We don't know who Haggith or Abital are. Apparently wives David took later on, or maybe concubines. And the sixth, Ithream, by David's wife Eglah, again of whom we know nothing else, except that she had a very unattractive name. These were born to David in Hebron. Okay, now, the firstborn son, as we see, and who would have been king after David when he died, was Amnon. But Amnon disqualified himself in almost the same way that Reuben disqualified himself from Jacob's birthright. Reuben was the oldest son of Jacob, but because of his unbridled lust, because he went to Jacob's concubine and slept with her, he was deprived of his birthright. He was described by Jacob in the 49th chapter of Genesis as unstable as water. You can't have someone ruling the family and ruling the nation who can't rule his own lusts. David, by the way, we don't know how good he was at ruling his lusts. He legally apparently married most of the women that he had relations with, although later on he definitely found himself to be compromising in that area. But Amnon, it's hard to know whether Amnon would have become king anyway in spite of his raping of his half-sister Tamar, but he didn't have a chance because Tamar was a sister of Absalom, and Absalom took vengeance for his sister on Amnon, killed Amnon. So Amnon was killed violently, and Chileab we read nothing of again, and in all likelihood he died young. Chileab's the second born. He would have been the next natural heir, but he died in all likelihood young, too young to ever make his mark in David's family history. Then we have, of course, Absalom, the thirdborn. He would have been king, except he was exiled, banished because of his killing of Amnon. After that, we have Adonijah, who thought himself to be the next in line for king and sought to make himself king. When David was on his sick bed and thought his death was near, Adonijah got some of the troops and the priests on his side and had some people declare him king. However, he was not David's choice. David chose Solomon, who we do not read of here yet because David has not yet married Bathsheba or had Solomon yet. These are sons that were born to him in Hebron. He had others later on, including Solomon. But Solomon became the one that was a choice, and Adonijah's bid for the throne was a failure, and later he lost his life. Verse 6. Now it was so, while there was war between the house of Saul and the house of David, that Abner was strengthening his hold on the house of Saul. That is to say, it was becoming more and more a military controlled government, although Ishbosheth was the token king because he had royal blood. He was really a weak character, not a respected leader, and Abner was really the one, the power behind the throne. Abner was the one who really made the decisions, and Ishbosheth kind of went along meekly with him. Now, Saul had a concubine whose name was Rizpah, the daughter of Aiah. So Ishbosheth said to Abner, "Why have you gone into my father's concubine?" Now, Abner is offended by the question, but he doesn't deny that he did it. And it doesn't seem like Ishbosheth would have made such a confrontation unless there was some reason to believe it was true. It must have been rumored or known that Abner had done this. But why would he do this? Didn't Abner have access to other women? Why would he want to go into a concubine of Saul? Well, in ancient kingdoms, for a man to sleep with the wives or concubines of the previous king would be his declaration of his own place as the supplanter of the previous king. He's the successor. We see that Absalom does this with David's wives. When Absalom wants to declare himself the new king, he actually takes David's wives and concubines up on the roof in public and sleeps with them. Later on, when Solomon is king, Adonijah desires to take the previous concubine of David. Actually, she wasn't a concubine that David ever had sex with, but she had slept to keep him warm in his old age. And Adonijah requests the right to marry her. And Solomon recognizes this as a bid for the throne, because it was customary for if a man could take another man's wives and concubines to sleep with them, it was clear that he had replaced that man. And so Abner may very well have been guilty of the thing that Ishbosheth says. Abner was getting stronger, and he may have even decided to make a bid for the throne himself. Having nothing but contempt for the weak leadership of Ishbosheth, he may have decided, okay, I'm going to call myself the king here. And he may have, in fact, gone into Saul's concubine and slept with her as a symbolic gesture of claiming that position. We do not read that Abner actually did it. We only read the accusation. But Ishbosheth is a rather meek and retiring individual and would have certainly been intimidated by Abner and would probably not make such an accusation against Abner unless there was some strong reasons for believing that it had actually happened. Abner does not deny it. He just shows indignation that he should be so accused. Abner became very angry at the words of Ishbosheth and said, "Am I a dog's head that belongs to Judah? Today I show loyalty to the house of Saul your father, to his brothers and to his friends, and have not delivered you into the hand of David. And you charge me today with fault concerning this woman? May God do so to Abner and more also, if I do not do for David as the Lord has sworn to him, to transfer the kingdom from the house of Saul and to set up the throne of David over Israel and over Judah from Dan to Beersheba." And he couldn't answer Abner another word because he feared him. Now, what I find amazing here is that Abner admits God had promised to David that he would transfer Saul's kingdom to him. And yet, up to this point, Abner has resisted this. Admitting and knowing that this is God's declared will, Abner has been doing what he knows not to be God's will. Why? Because he could hold a position if David was not king. He would not be able to hold a position if David was. So Abner, for position's sake alone, had up to this point been resisting what he knew God's purpose to be. So he was not a godly man in any sense. Then Abner sent messengers on his behalf to David, saying, "Whose is the land?" Saying also, "Make your covenant with me, and indeed my hand shall be with you and bring all Israel to you." Now, in saying whose is the land, what he probably is implying is, officially everyone considers that the land belongs to Ishbosheth, but whose is it really? It's mine. I'm Abner. I'm the one in charge here. I have the power to give it to you, David, not Ishbosheth. He's a wimp. He doesn't have anything. Whose is the land anyway? It's mine, is what Abner, I'm really in control here, and if I want to, I can give you all the land, David, if you want to rule over all of Israel. So that's the message he sends to David. And David said, "Good, I will make a covenant with you. But one thing I require of you, you shall not see my face unless you first bring Michal, Saul's daughter, when you come to see my face." So David sent messengers to Ishbosheth, Saul's son, saying, "Give me the wife of Michal, whom I betrothed to myself for 100 foreskins of the Philistines." And Ishbosheth sent and took her from her husband, from Paltiel, the son of Laish. Then her husband went along with her to Bahurim, weeping behind her. So Abner said to him, "Go, return." And he returned. Now Abner had communicated with the elders of Israel, saying, "In time past you were seeking for David to be king over you. Now then do it. For the Lord has spoken of David, saying, 'By the hand of my servant David I will save my people, Israel, from the hand of the Philistines and from the hand of all their enemies.'" So Abner had been running a campaign for David because he was angry at Ishbosheth for confronting him. And so he was turning basically the nation over to the side of David so that he could make good on his promise to David that he could deliver them to David as his subjects. And Abner also spoke in the hearing of Benjamin. That would be the tribe of Benjamin. Then Abner also went to speak in the hearing of David in Hebron, all that seemed good to Israel and to the whole house of Benjamin. The reason Benjamin is mentioned separately is, of course, is because Saul and his family were of Benjamin. And the Benjamites would be the least likely to be persuaded to give over the kingdom to someone from another tribe, from their own. But he managed to persuade them too. Apparently they were not impressed with their man in office either. So Abner and 20 men with him came down to David at Hebron, and David made a feast for Abner and the men who were with him. Then Abner said to David, I will arise and go and gather all Israel to my lord the king, that they may make a covenant with you, and that you may reign over all that your heart desires. So David sent Abner away, and he went in peace. At that moment, the servants of David and Joab came in from a raid and brought much spoil with them. But Abner was not with David in Hebron, for he had sent him away, and he had gone away in peace. When Joab and all the troops that were with him had come, they told Joab, saying, Abner, the son of Ner, came to the king, and he sent him away, and he has gone in peace. And apparently a lot of people in David didn't like the implications of this. Then Joab came to the king and said, what have you done? Look, Abner came to you. Why is it that you have sent him away and he has already gone? Surely you realize that Abner, the son of Ner, came to deceive you, to know you're going out and you're coming in, and to know all that you are doing. And when Joab had gone from David's presence, he sent messengers after Abner, who brought him back from the well of Sirah. But David did not know it. Now when Abner had returned to Hebron, Joab took him aside in the gate to speak with him privately, and there he stabbed him in the stomach, so that he died for the blood of Asahel, his brother. So Abner was killed treacherously by Joab, and this was not really for the good of Israel. This was a personal vendetta Joab had because his brother Asahel, it was a blood feud. Now, Joab, by the way, this is the first time we read of Joab really acting against the spirit of David. And many, many times after this, there will be some conflict between Joab and David, including and maybe culminating in the fact that David orders his troops not to kill Absalom at a later date, and Joab brazenly just goes and kills him and doesn't care what David says. Joab apparently felt like he had as much power over David as Abner had over Ishbosheth. Now, David never did punish Joab during his lifetime, but when he was dying, he told Solomon, remember what Joab did to me, and later Solomon had Joab executed for some of these treacherous things he did. Now, it could be argued that Joab was a better politician or military man than David was. David was too soft-hearted. Now, that's good. It's good to be soft-hearted. He was very Christ-like in some ways, very quick to forgive his enemies and not hold any grudges and so forth. And that's good for people in general to have a good attitude. But when a ruler is charged with the security of his land, you be careful about being too friendly with your enemies. And there are many times when Joab's actions would seem to be more expeditious, he had more wisdom about the security of the nation than David did. For David to welcome Abner like this could have opened Israel up to treachery and to espionage and to defeat at the hands of Abner. And that is what Joab claimed to be the case. Now, in this case, I think Joab was acting on other motives because we seem to be told that. However, later on, when David begged the armies not to kill Absalom, David, I think, was foolish in that case. Joab, though acting against the king's orders, probably did what would be considered to be the wise thing in killing Absalom. If Absalom had been allowed to stay, he could have staged another uprising. After all, the people followed Absalom so much. How could David win their hearts back with Absalom still alive? Joab understood politics better than David did. David was just a man after God's heart, which is better than understanding politics. But as a pragmatist, Joab was a no-nonsense kind of leader, and David was kind of a vacillating, soft-hearted, easygoing, quickly forgiving, quick to trust people who are not trustworthy, slow to punish people. That's the kind of guy David was. And so in some ways, Joab is the better leader than David is, but that's only seen through the world's eyes. In worldly ways, he is. David is much more a man like Christ, a much more a man after God's heart. Well, let's consider what was going on here with Joab and Abner. David was willing to peaceably allow Abner to turn over the northern kingdom to David. That would bring an end to the ongoing wars, the long wars between the house of David and the house of Saul. Joab was a military leader. Military leaders, you know, some of them get their kicks out of war. I'm not saying all of them do, but I mean, war is what they're all about. When there's no war, there's not much need for them. I mean, maybe to just kind of be body king or something, but military leaders are far more important in the eyes of the nation when there's a war being fought. If Abner had surrendered the nation of Israel to David, that'd be the end of the war. But it would also be the end of hostilities between David and Abner, and Abner might jockey himself into a position of leadership in the standing army that was equal or even superior to Joab's. Knowing David's tendency to forgive his enemies and give him another chance, Abner was a threat and a rival to Joab. In addition to that, he had killed Joab's brother. So on the pretense, or maybe it wasn't pretense, maybe Joab really believed that Abner was planning to overthrow David, when in fact we are told that Abner was really going to give the kingdom to David. Abner did not have the motives that Joab ascribed to him here. Joab was in good faith going to turn the kingdom over, Abner was. But Abner was a bad man. Abner was a wicked man, and he deserved to die in the manner that he did. He had been in rebellion against Jehovah's known purposes in this matter from the beginning. And he came to his just end. But Joab's treachery and Joab's vindictiveness and so forth was not really done in the interest of the nation. It was in the interest of settling a blood feud between them because of Azahel. Now, David, when he heard of it, was very upset with Joab. It's the first time we read of David being upset with Joab, but there will be other times. And David said to Joab and to all the people who were with him, "Tear your clothes, gird yourselves with sackcloth, and mourn for Abner." And King David followed the coffin. That is, at the funeral, David followed the coffin of Abner as he was being buried to honor him at his burial. So they buried Abner in Hebron, and the king lifted up his voice and wept at the grave of Abner. And all the people wept, and the king sang a lament over Abner and said, "Should Abner die as a fool dies? Your hands were not bound, nor were your feet in fetters. As a man falls before wicked men, so you fell." Implying, therefore, that Joab was a wicked man. Now, this is not good policy for the king if he wants to endear his chief military staff officer to himself. Here, he's basically, Joab has killed Abner. In the nation's eyes, the nation of Judah, they say, "Hey, this is good. Abner's been our enemy. We've won the war because of Joab's great, you know, victory here over Abner." But here the king almost sides with Abner against Joab. He honors him at his funeral. He speaks of Joab as if he were a wicked man for killing him. And, you know, this might be wise if Abner was still alive to be on David's side. But Joab's one who's still alive, and David's insulting him in public. And this is not going to bode well for their relationship. And when all the people to persuade David to eat food while it was still day, David took an oath, saying, "God do so to me and more also if I taste bread or anything else till the sun goes down." So all the people took note of it, and it pleased them, since whatever the king did pleased all the people. As David was enjoying popularity at this time, and his gracious spirit toward his enemies was one of those things that was winsome about him. For all the people in all Israel understood that day that it had not been the king's intent to kill Abner, the son of Ner. Now, it's possible, I mean, I don't want to suspect David. David could have been doing a lot of this for show. Now, I'm not saying he was. He may have really cared about Abner. We don't read of any friendship between him and Abner at any previous time, but he may have cared about him. He may have really felt sorry for him. But it's also possible that David was maneuvering the sympathies of Israel. After all, David may have known more about politics than to give him credit for. He may have known that Abner had been the hero of the northern tribes, which David now hoped to rule. If the northern tribes viewed David as a man who treacherously murdered their leader in cold blood, it might not endear David very much to Abner's people. But David putting on this outward, clear demonstration of his regret and mourning over the death of Abner was advertising to the people of the northern kingdom that he did not have any hand in this. He did not approve of this. He was innocent of this, so that the people of Israel might hate Joab, but they wouldn't hate David. And he was basically distancing himself publicly from what Joab had done. And, you know, that may have been entirely sincere, but it also may have been a political move to make sure that the people who still liked Abner up in the northern kingdom would not hold this against David and withhold their loyalty to him. Then the king said to his servants, "Do you not know that a prince and a great man has fallen this day in Israel? And I am weak today, though anointed king. And these men, the sons of Zeruiah, are too harsh for me." That'd be Joab and Abishai and Azahel before his death. "These sons of Zeruiah, they're too harsh for me. The Lord shall repay the evildoer according to his wickedness." Now chapter 4. And when Saul's son, that's Ishbosheth, heard that Abner had died in Hebron, he lost heart. I guess so. I mean, Abner wasn't a very good friend of his, but he was the best he had. He didn't have anyone else to defend him, and now he's totally vulnerable. And all Israel was troubled. Now Saul's son had two men who were captains of troops. The name of one was Baanah, and the name of the other was Rechab. the sons of Rimmon, the Beerothite. Now, these were brothers and both officers in Ishbosheth's army. And they were of the children of Benjamin. For Beeroth also was part of Benjamin, because the Beerothites fled to Gittim and have been sojourners there until this day. Jonathan, Saul's son, had a son who was lame in his feet. Of course, Jonathan's now dead, but we're now learning that Jonathan, before his death, had fathered a son who was now 5 years old when the news about Saul and Jonathan was real. And his nurse took him up and fled, and it happened as she made haste to flee that she fell, and he became lame. He fell. She either dropped him or she fell on him and injured his, must have broken a leg and twisted it bad so that he didn't walk properly from that point on. So his name was Mephibosheth. Now, we are told about Mephibosheth now, but we'll hear more about him later. It may be that the reason for mentioning Mephibosheth here is that the reader may wonder, well, if Ishbosheth gets assassinated, which he's going to in the next few verses, why would not, if there's a remaining offspring of Saul, Jonathan's son Mephibosheth, why would not he become the next king? I mean, why would the death of Ishbosheth automatically put David in control when there's still a remaining heir to the throne, Jonathan? And perhaps this little bit of information, in order to point out that, well, for one thing, Mephibosheth was only 12 and a half years old when Ishbosheth died. But that's not too young to take the kingdom. Later on, there were kings of Judah who took the throne at age 8. But probably the fact that he was a cripple is what's important. The crippled state of Mephibosheth is never significant in the narrative otherwise. I take that back. It may come into an important play later when Absalom dropped out and David wonders why Mephibosheth couldn't go with him, and turns out that Mephibosheth said, well, I'm lame. But it may be mentioned here that Mephibosheth was lame in order to say that, you know, the nation wouldn't have a lame king. The king has to be not only of the right bloodlines, he's got to be a great physical specimen. He's got to be a sort of the poster boy for the whole nation. And a lame grandson of the king would not be an acceptable icon for the nation of Israel in the way that they thought of kings those. Remember, Saul was chosen maybe partly because he was so big. He's a big guy and good looking. Big and good looking mattered in those days for a national symbol that the king had to be. And so we may be reading here about Mephibosheth, although it's out of place because he'll be a focus later on. Simply because we're about to read of the death of Ishbosheth, and his death would seemingly leave a vacancy that if there was a grandson of Saul available, we'd expect him to fill it. But we're told, yes, there was a grandson of Saul, but he was lame, and therefore, of course, he's not available. He would not qualify as a king candidate. Verse 5, then the sons of Rimmon, the Beerothite, Rechab and Baana, set out and came at about the heat of the day to the house of Ishbosheth, who was lying on his bed at noon. In the heat of the day in the Middle East, just like in Mexico and some other hot lands, people don't usually do their business. They take a siesta. And so he was in the heat of the day laying on his bed, as probably usual. And they came there all day into the house as though to get wheat, and they stabbed him in the stomach. Then Rechab and Baana, his brother, escaped. For when they came into the house, he was lying on his bed in his bedroom. Then they struck him and killed him, beheaded him, and took his head, and were all night escaping through the plain. And they brought the head of Ishbosheth to David at Hebron, and said to the king, here is the head of Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, your enemy, who sought your life. And the Lord has avenged my lord the king this day and his descendants. Then David answered Rechab and Baana, his brother, the sons of Rimmon, the Beerothite, and said to them, as the Lord lives, who has redeemed my life from all adversity, when someone told me, saying, look, Saul is dead, thinking to have brought good news, I arrested him and had him executed in Ziklag, the one who thought I would have given him a reward for his news. How much more, when wicked men have killed a righteous person in his own house on his bed? Therefore shall I not now require his blood at your hand and remove you from the earth? So David commanded his young men, they executed them, cut off their hands and feet. Wicked hands and feet they were, and hanged them by the pool in Hebron. But they took the head of Ishbosheth and buried it, gave it his head a decent burial, in the tomb of Abner in Hebron. Didn't have the rest of his body there. But we see that these two servants of Ishbosheth, they did not feel that they were powerful enough to step into the vacuum created by Abner's death. Neither of them had quite the charisma or the clout that Abner had, so they had to make a decision. Are we going to wait for someone to come up and replace Abner? Or are we just going to stand by and watch David come in and slaughter Saul and take control by force? Listen, we can give it to David and we'll get a reward. Instead of getting killed by David, we'll get favor from David. So we'll just kill Ishbosheth. And they, again, miscalculated David's attitude toward his enemies. He described Ishbosheth as a righteous man. Even though Ishbosheth had sent his army David and against David's armies, he wasn't saying that he was righteous in the sense that we'd say Jesus is righteous or God is righteous, but he was righteous in the sense he was innocent. He hadn't done anything to deserve his servant's treachery. And so he had them executed too. David was full of surprises for people who didn't quite understand his what made him tick. Let's go on now to chapter 5. I think we can get through this chapter, and that'll put us pretty much on schedule here. Then all the tribes of Israel came to David at Hebron and spoke, saying, "Indeed, we are your bone and your flesh." Yeah, now they say so. But, you know, the tribe of Judah had said so 7.5 years earlier. Now all of Israel that's been fighting for 7.5 years say, "Oh, we're your relatives, we're your brothers, we're your bone and your flesh. We just remembered." When we have suddenly found ourselves vulnerable without an army, without a commander, without a king, suddenly it just occurred to us, "Oh, by the way, you're a relative of ours, aren't you? We're your relatives. Certainly we wouldn't want to make war with you, and you wouldn't want to make war with us, right? Also, time passed when Saul was king over us. You were the one who led Israel out and brought them in. And the Lord said to you, 'You shall shepherd my people Israel and be ruler over my people.'" Now, if David wanted to be catty, he could say, "You know that? You knew the Lord had said I'm supposed to be the shepherd, and yet you had Ishbosheth and Saul and pursued me and fought with me? What's the story here?" But anyway, he doesn't call him on it. Of course, it must have occurred to him. So all the elders of Israel came to the king at Hebron, and King David made a covenant with them at Hebron before the Lord, and they anointed David king over Israel. So 7.5 years after he had been anointed at Hebron over Judah, he now becomes anointed over the rest of the tribes and becomes the universal king. David was 30 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 40 years. Now, when he began to reign, has to be when he began to reign over Judah, because we read in verse 5, "In Hebron he reigned over Judah 7 years and 6 months, and he reigned 33 years over all Israel and Judah." So 33 years and 7 years, it includes the first 7.5 years over Hebron, and that's 40 years. So he lived to be 70, and he was 30 when Saul died and when he became king over Judah. Now, we don't know anything about his exact age prior to that time. How long he served in the court of Saul before he fled from Saul, and how long he fled from Saul and all that, we don't know. But it's probable. We can't say for sure. It seems likely that he was probably in his 20s when he killed Goliath. We don't know for sure, but he might have only been in his late teens, hard to say. He was 30, though, after serving with Saul for some time in Saul's court, and then fleeing from Saul for some undesignated time. He was 30 years old. So he was probably 20 or above when he first appears in the story, but we're not sure. It mentions Jerusalem in verse 5, that he reigned in Jerusalem. However, that is anticipating something that has not yet happened. The conquest of Jerusalem now has to be recorded. Hebron has been David's capital all this time. Jerusalem is not even a Jewish city at this time. It is in Israel, but it has never been conquered. Joshua left Jerusalem an unconquered Jebusite, that is, Canaanite city. And the Jebusites who were there had defied Israel. Even for hundreds of years, Israel had occupied the land, but this city remained inviolate, had not been conquered by the Jews. David grew up in the shadow of that city. Bethlehem is about 6 miles from there. And my suspicion is that David had always thought as a youth that that city was standing there in violation of God, because those Canaanites shouldn't be there. That's supposed to be a Jewish city, but the Jews had never successfully conquered it. You may remember that when David killed Goliath, we read that he took, and inexplicably it says he took the head of Goliath and he hung it up over toward Jerusalem. Why? Perhaps as a warning to the people, the Jebusites there, someday I'm going to do the same to you. Here's what I've done to this Philistine. You guys are next. When I come to power, I'm going to conquer you too. Because they didn't belong there. They were supposed to be exterminated hundreds of years earlier, and they stood in defiance of God, having given the land to his people Israel. And David, when he finally has the whole nation on his side, his first order of business is to go conquer Jerusalem. I wouldn't be surprised if that had been a lifelong goal of his growing up in Bethlehem and thinking that it was entirely inappropriate for Jerusalem to exist there in defiance to God's giving his inheritance to Israel. So The king and his men went to Jerusalem against the Jebusites, the inhabitants of the land, who spoke to David, "You shall not come in here, but the blind and the lame will repel you," thinking David cannot come here. Now, when they said the blind and lame will repel you, basically what they're saying is, you're so weak that we don't even have to put our best soldiers against you. You can't conquer this city. It had great walls. It was a tremendous walled city. And they were basically mocking him, saying, we can just keep our blind and lame on the wall and they can repel you from here. Nevertheless, David took the stronghold of Zion, that is the city of David, that is Jerusalem. Now, tells how he did it. Now, David said on that day, whoever climbs up by way of the water shaft and defeats the Jebusites, the lame and the blind, who are ahead of David's soul, he's calling them all lame and blind, echoing their own words, he shall be chief and captain. Notice it says they are loathed by David's soul. We're not told any reason in particular why he was so upset with these people. But as I say, it strikes me as he had a lifelong vendetta against these people just because they were there and didn't belong there. He speaks of the Jebusites as those who are loathed by him. He says, whoever climbs up by way of the water shaft and defeats the Jebusites, he shall be chief and captain. So David's given away military posts to those who will do the definitive thing of conquering Jerusalem. Therefore, they say, the blind and the lame shall not come up into the house. Apparently became a saying, though it's not entirely clear how it's connected with the narrative. So David dwelt in the stronghold and called it the city of David. Then David built all around from Millo and inward, that's a district in Jerusalem. So David went on and became great, and the Lord God of hosts was with him. So David conquered Jerusalem finally. He had been standing there for 440 years about, since Joshua's time, and he finally, almost a half a millennium after it should have been conquered, he conquered it. And, of course, he made it his capital. Then Hiram, the king of Tyre, whom we will also find in the story of Solomon, Hiram, the king of Tyre, ends up donating a lot of wood to Solomon to build the temple, and workers too, sent messengers to David and cedar trees, carpenters and masons, and they built David a house. Now, Tyre is a nation just to the north, actually a city, but a very powerful city-state. And David was recognized as superior in strength, so the king of Tyre wanted to make friends with him to avoid hassles in the future. So they came and built David a nice house. So David knew that the Lord had established him as king over Israel, and that he had exalted his kingdom for his people Israel's sake. And David took more concubines and wives from Jerusalem after he had come from Hebron. Also, more sons and daughters were born to David. Now, these are the names of those who were born to him in Jerusalem. Shemua, Shobab, Nathan, Solomon, Ibhar, Elishua, Nepheg, Japhia, Elishama, Eliada, and Eliphelet. Now, Solomon is mentioned here, as well as some of these others, by way of anticipation. Solomon was born much, much later in David's life, but it's just summarizing all the sons that eventually were born to him in his lifetime after he conquered Jerusalem. Verse 17, now the Philistines heard that they had anointed David king over Israel. All the Philistines went up to search for David, but David heard of it, and he went down to the stronghold. The Philistines also went and deployed themselves in the valley of Rephaim. And David inquired of the Lord, saying, shall I go up against the Philistines? Will you deliver them into my hand? And the Lord said to David, go up, for I will doubtless deliver the Philistines into your hand. So David went to Baal Perazim, and David defeated them there. And he said, the Lord has broken through my enemies before me like a breakthrough of water. Therefore, he called the name of the place Baal Perazim, which means the breaking through of Baal. And that is, he broke through the powers of Baal, apparently, or master. Baal means master of breakthroughs. And they left their images there, and David and his men carried them away. Then the Philistines went up once again and deployed themselves in the valley of Rephaim. And when David inquired of the Lord, he said, you shall not go up, circle around behind them, and come upon them in front of the mulberry trees. So it shall be, when you hear the sound of marching in the tops of the mulberry trees, then you shall advance quickly, for then the Lord will go out before you and strike the camp of the Philistines. And David did so, as the Lord had commanded him, and he drove back the Philistines from Geba as far as Gezer. Now, in all likelihood, the Philistines attacked him because, A, they were mad. He had pretended to be their friend in the days of Saul, but as soon as Saul was dead, he came back to Israel and was no longer friendly with the Philistines. Secondly, they were afraid of him. They didn't bother him too much when he only ruled over Judah because he wasn't a big threat, but now that the whole nation of Israel was on his side, he had a lot of troops at his command, and so the Philistines said they'd better nip this power in the bud. But they were unsuccessful in both campaigns. This marching at the top of the mulberry trees, no doubt, is the sound of angels marching. There are other times in the Bible where angels of God are seen involved in Israel's battles. And God says, don't march until you hear the sound of marching in the mulberry trees, and you'll know God has gone before you. You see, God not only had to tell Israel when to go to war, but how. And so, ideally, Israel's battles were fought strictly under the command and direction of God. We stop here, and we'll talk more about his bringing the ark to Jerusalem in the next chapter, but that'll be next time.